It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. Thank you for joining me. My guest this morning is Kerry Loft, who is the director of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership, America's leading entity looking at economic efficiency and program delivery across the conservation spectrum. And it's a incredibly important work that's being done. And I thought Kerry would give us a little bit of an update on some of the things that are occurring on a national basis that we might want to be thinking about. But before Kerry joins us, I have to recount something that happened on Friday morning that all the years I've been outside, I've never had occur before. It was dark about 6 o'clock in the morning. I was crossing the part of the Great Salt Lake in a howling windstorm with a little bit of rain coming behind it. We were traveling north with about a 25 mile an hour south wind, moving at about 15 miles an hour in a boat across the Great Salt Lake, when we ran into a flock of canvasback, maybe 1,000 birds, maybe more. With the lights of the boat, it was hard to tell. But what wasn't hard to tell was that it was either going to be the ducks or us. And we entered that flock of canvasback. They began to fly. Diving ducks have to take off directly into the wind for them to be able to leave. And, of course, we're coming downwind on them. We immediately idled the boat and hit the deck for cover. As canvasbacks hurtled by us, I could have grabbed them without even outstretching my arm. We heard this thud, and a drake canvasback went straight into the bow of the boat. We heard another thud, and another drake canvasback cracked the motor in the back of the boat, and we literally took cover. And when the canvasback flight was gone, in the darkness, I turned to my friend who I was with, and I said, that would have been a great headline, Ducks Get Final Revenge. In any event, we had two canvasback in the boat without ever having uncased our guns or done anything of the kind in the dark in Great Salt Lake. Never happened before, and I hope it never happens again. But to run up on a flock of cans that had arrived probably overnight from the north was both startling and also sad in the way that they couldn't get out of our way and we couldn't get out of their way. And with that introduction, good morning, Kerry.
Good morning, Charlie. How are you?
I'm with us. It would have been quite a headline. And since you used to write headlines, I'm sure you could have come up with a better one, but that was the best we could do.
They should have ducked.
They should have ducked. Well, it's you and I have had the pleasure of being outdoors together many times on all kinds of adventures, whether it's been walking or hunting or just enjoying watching nature. Kerry, this morning, I thought we would cover a bit of ground to do with what the landscape is shaping up for in 2018. There's still work to be done, obviously, this year. But let's start off, Kerry. You, as the director of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership, are leading the way on a national discussion as to what ag conservation policy might look like in the possibility we have an upcoming farm bill. First of all, what's your take as to whether we're actually going to have a farm bill? What would be some of the things that have to happen? And then what would be some of the most important things we could do if we do have a farm bill?
Yeah. Well, those are great questions, Charlie, because since 1985, the federal farm bills have been among the most important, if not the most important, pieces of federal legislation used to fund conservation in America. And as you are well aware, and your listeners are probably well aware, the Conservation Reserve Program has been the one that has gotten the most headlines over the years, largely because of its benefits for upland game birds and waterfowl. The explosion of pheasants that we were lucky enough to see in the late 80s through the mid-90s to even the first part of the 2000s in the Great Plains, the Dakotas, in Iowa, Kansas, that was largely built on the back of the Conservation Reserve Program, which protects erodible, vulnerable lands from crop production, that pays farmers to take them out of production and put them into prairie, essentially switchgrasses, other plants that are very beneficial to wildlife. That's not the primary driver of the CRP, but it was a happy coincidence that those of us who like to chase a bird dog in the uplands benefited from mightily. But one of the things that's fragile about CRP, Charlie, is that as commodity prices raise and go higher, farmers look at the land that they set aside for 10 years in most cases and say, gee, I could put that back into production. So the popularity of CRP with the private landowner, who is, as I believe, and as I believe you believe, is really the key to delivering conservation on the ground in America. It's the private landowner who can do more than anyone else, maybe not as an individual, but as an entity. Private landowners hold most of the land where our game and fish are harbored. They can do the most to impact them, pro and con. Their enthusiasm, if you will, for CRP has diminished as commodity prices rise, and there have been some problems with it. And frankly, some of the land that has been in conservation reserve for a long time no longer has the carrying capacity that it once did for upland game birds and other wildlife. So, meantime, since the first Farm Bill conservation title was passed in 1985, a host of new technological developments have come on the market that are used every day by farmers, things like GPS technology. And I would hope that the next Farm Bill harnesses these GPS, these technologies, promotes their use in identifying the most vulnerable lands, and encourages farmers to use that as they select the lands that are available for set-aside programs. It would allow them to minimize impact on their overall land holdings while still getting great conservation benefits for us. So that would be something that I would like to see. Our friends at Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, other traditional hook and bullet based organizations, they are pushing for an expansion of CRP. I believe the cap right now is 32 million acres, Charlie, is that right? And God bless them. I hope they get it, because CRP is a great program. But with money tight and farmers being a little bit skeptical after 32 years, it might be a tough sell to grow CRP in the next Farm Bill.
We're visiting with Kerry Luft, who's the director of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership. And Kerry, I guess I would ask, one of the things that you told me recently in a conversation was that we being America, should capture technology and innovation in addressing conservation, and that Conservation Reserve Program, the Wetland Enhancement Program, what's called the Wetland Reserve Program, other programs like it tend to be broad brushes in the landscape rather than precision or smart conservation. Can you take a couple moments to describe what you're talking about? And we have a very large farm audience on WGN here.
Sure.
To explain to them why you think there's a possibility that we will have a new way of looking at conservation that's better for the landowner and better for the U.S. taxpayer.
Well, look at it this way, Charlie. Under conservation reserve programs, which is the program I'm most familiar with, huge swaths of land were put into CRP, quarter sections, half sections, whole sections. That's 640 acres for our more urban listeners. Whole sections of land, hundreds of acres at a time, at minimum 40 acres or so, you know, big patches of land. And, you know, that's just great if you've got a bird dog in the back of your pickup truck and you want to turn him loose and try to rustle up some pheasants or quail or a sharp-tailed grouse. But that is a lot of production that the landowner is, in essence, giving up. In essence, we are telling farmers, we're going to them, if you compare them to factory owners, hey, we're going to give you a payment, but we're going to have you take a significant portion of your capacity out of production. And in some years, it sounds pretty good. Over the course of 10 years, doesn't sound so good, maybe. What precision conservation would allow you to do, Charlie, is to use these technologies that are used every day in agriculture. They use it to plant. They use it to analyze the profitability of a field. They use it to analyze plant densities, optimal, getting the most out of their land. this would allow you to take, say, a 40-acre patch and say, oh, now here's an acre and a half, perhaps, that isn't in a square or an oblong or even a triangle. It might be a serpentine, rather amorphous blob on the landscape, but it is highly erodible, highly susceptible to problems, environmental problems, or better, or more likely, it can be used quite effectively to filter nutrient runoff into the watersheds. By doing that, you can take out the minimum amount of land needed for efficient conservation impact on the landscape and farm all around it. You can get a high percentage of the maximum potential for conservation, particularly in terms of nutrient runoff into watersheds, which is a big problem in this country. You could do that for a minimum of taking the whole field out of production. And that's that the strips, which is what they would be, they would still have plenty of nesting cover and habitat for birds and other valuable species that people like to see on the landscape.
And I suppose the other part of it is, and we'll take a break, Carrie, just a second, the other part of it is these areas under precision conservation also generally tend to be the areas of farm fields that are the least profitable, if in fact they are profitable at all. And I know one of the things that's being worked on are matrix, and certainly every farmer knows exactly what we're talking about, is you have highly profitable areas of a field and you have areas that are in fact unprofitable. And if conservation could target the unprofitable areas, which tend to be the ones that are most important for filtering of nitrogen or working on other elements of soil and water conservation, which give wildlife benefits, a landowner might actually have a win-win, farming the good land while being able to set aside but be rewarded for their contributions to conservation. Carrie, we'll be back in just a moment. And when we do, I'd love to get your thoughts on an article that was recently written by Bob Marshall in New Orleans on the well intentions of bringing back wetlands, in this case along the Gulf Coast, but the incredible bureaucratic elements that are in front of us, set up by a myriad of organizations and regulations that in fact may make it almost impossible to deliver soil and water buildup for the Gulf of Mexico. We're visiting with Carrie Lopt, who is the director of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership. And this is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from your Northern Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. I'm visiting with Carrie Lopt, who is director of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership. And Carrie, as we move from some of the big pictures that might happen, should we have a farm bill in 2018? And I guess a lot of us feel that that is pretty much going to be predicated as to whether or not we actually have tax reform prior to that, because if tax reform drags out into 2018, it makes the likelihood of a farm bill much less likely to occur. But one of the things, Carrie, that's lost in all this is how the efforts to restore the Gulf Coast marshes of Louisiana, which are the epicenter and really the heart of what needs to be done to sustain the Gulf of Mexico and fisheries and a lot of migratory bird populations, how they are ensnared in just a morass of environmental regulations. You want to just take a moment to try to explain what is going on and why this is really an example of government run amok?
Charlie, we've talked about this many, many times in the past. The crisis in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast is unprecedented in its magnitude. It threatens businesses, lives, homes, not to mention some of the most crucial fisheries and waterfowl habitat, migratory bird habitat in North America. And what has happened, Charlie, is that Louisiana does have a coastal master plan that calls for some very innovative ways to restore or try to restore land down at the Mississippi. This would be by cutting diversions into the Mississippi River and allowing the sediment that currently is shooting out into the Gulf of Mexico to spill out over the Bird's Foot Delta and other parts of South Louisiana, in essence recreating what the river should have been doing for many decades at this point. The problem is that the permitting process to do this has to pass no more than muster with no more than about 80 federal laws and executive orders designed to protect the safety of everything from speckled trout, which is a sea trout, a sea weak fish, to bottlenose dolphins. And the frustrating part of this is there are these big projects on the books that could really do some good to turn to help slow the tide of coastal land loss in Louisiana. And they're bogged down in a years-long permitting process, if they ever get through at all. The irony, as Bob Marshall, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, pointed out in a column not too long ago, is that some of these regulations that are slowing down the process are designed to protect species that should not be in those areas in the first place. They are only in the areas where they could be threatened by these coastal restoration projects because of the degradation of the marsh that has allowed salt water to intrude. For example, one of the big sediment diversions would possibly threaten a small colony of bottlenose dolphins. Well, the area where those dolphins live shouldn't be salt water. It should be fresh water. All that the Coastal Master Plan calls for is restoring that area back to the way it should be, which is fresh water. And so you have a very ironic situation in that some of the people who are the most in favor of regulations to protect the environment say, hey, it's going too far here. We can't even restore things to their natural order. It's a story that just turns all logic on its head, and it needs to be resolved pretty darn quickly because Louisiana loses football fields of land every day, and it is a crucial, crucial problem for the United States.
Well, let me ask, Harry, we've got a couple minutes left. Let me ask, as a layperson, and those listening this morning are probably scratching their heads. Let me ask, shouldn't there be a way for this master plan to say that there are no species that will be preserved that are in habitat today, which was not their natural habitat? In other words, in restoring these marshes, we're going to run into the commercial shrimp boat operations, of course, who are making shrimp are now taking place in lots of places where they didn't. You're going to run into the dolphins. You're going to run into all these species that didn't exist in these areas. Wouldn't there be a way to try to correct this by coming up with some overlay which says, in these areas, we are restoring them, and the invasive species, which is what they are not going to be considered?
The way to do that, Charlie, would be to create a new silo under environmental protection law. And that silo would speed or dramatically streamline the permitting process when it comes to restoring habitats to their natural status. That would be a very effective way of maintaining the necessary protections in place where needed while giving leeway to projects that are merely trying to return natural habitats to their original status. Details are tough.
Congratulations, Kerry. You've just given yourself something else to do. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. You're really kind with your time, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to Kerry Luft, who's the director of the McGraw Center for Conservation Leadership. And I will stay out of places where in the dark, where canvasbacks are rafting, because I'd like to be back with you next Sunday morning. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.
All right, there we go.
Thank you.
Tom, thank you very much.
No problem.
We'll pick next week, but I also think next week at this time probably works pretty well if it works for you.
Yeah, Friday 1:30, can do.
Okay.
Charlie, and you want to call me back or you want me to call you?
Yeah. I need 25 minutes. Can you call me back at what would be 2:15? Can you do that?
Correct. No problem.
Just call my cell at 2:15. Thanks, and Tom, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.